Good morning, everyone. We're delighted for you to be joining us. I am Jeremy Abramson. I'll be honored to help moderate this session entitled Consensus or Controversy, where our faculty pictured here are going to share perspectives on the management of follicular lymphoma. This is the faculty for today's meeting. I'll be privileged to be joined by the wonderful friends and colleagues, Dr. Jen Crombie from Dana-Farber and Dr. Lori Sen from the British Columbia Cancer Agency. In preparation for today's meeting, Research to Practice conducted a survey of today's faculty as well as three additional clinical investigators who all provided their perspectives on a number of issues related to follicular lymphoma management. We're only going to show you a selected number of these survey questions, but the full dossier of these questions are available for download for your interest and scrutiny. Here is the accreditation for you, including the disclosure and COI information, and this is all available to read in detail in your copy of today's slides. This program will contain disclosure of non-approved use of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for their approved indications. And of course, today's program is free of charge. If you have any questions about obtaining CME credit, please do email Research to Practice at the email address shown here. Let me show you where we're headed today. Here is our agenda. We are going to start with Dr. Crombie talking about how we're going to integrate bispecific antibodies in the management of follicular lymphoma. I will then talk about the role of CAR T cells in follicular lymphoma management. And then Dr. Sen will complete the circle by talking about approved and emerging novel therapies outside of the pure immunotherapy space in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. So an exciting schedule planned for you today. And so let's kick it off. Dr. Crombie, please come and talk to us about bispecific antibodies.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here today. So as you heard, I'll be starting with bispecific antibodies in follicular lymphoma. These are my disclosures. So an outline for this talk, we're going to start by reviewing the current available bispecific antibodies, CD3 by CD20, for follicular lymphoma. We'll review the efficacy and safety data from the pivotal studies in this space. And then lastly, we'll talk about some of the future directions of bispecific antibodies in follicular lymphoma. So here you can see the key bispecific antibodies that are being used or studied in follicular lymphoma. So mosunetuzumab and epcoritamab are the two that are currently FDA approved, and odronextamab is being studied in follicular lymphoma and has approval in Europe. There are some key differences, which we'll see as we go through the pivotal studies, but just to highlight here, mosunetuzumab is a primarily administered IV, though is being studied in the subcutaneous form. Epcoritamab is a subcutaneous form, and odronextamab is IV. These drugs are all 1:1 CD20 to CD3 binding, as you can see in the figure. So let's move into the studies. So we'll start with mosunetuzumab. This was the first drug that gained FDA approval. This is data from the pivotal phase 2 study in patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma who had received at least 2 prior lines of therapy. You can see some key inclusion criteria here, as well as the treatment schema with step-up dosing, a peak of 60 milligram dosing, and then a de-escalation that patients continue for a fixed duration of time, 8 cycles if patients achieve a CR, or 17 cycles for patients who achieve a PR or stable disease after cycle 8. And there was no mandatory hospitalization in this trial. So there were 90 patients enrolled. This was a heavily pretreated patient population with almost 70% of patients being refractory to their last prior line of therapy, a 3 median prior lines of therapy, and more than half of patients being POD 24. And so now we have 3 years of follow-up of this study and have seen an overall response rate of 80%, a complete response rate of 60%, and a median progression-free survival of 24 months. And you can see a flattening of that curve with time. Here's also some safety information with the key side effect, which is cytokine release syndrome. Cytokine release syndrome did occur in 44% of patients, though it was rare and was primarily grade 1 and 2, with 25% of patients having grade 1 CRS and 16% of patients having grade 2. And in this figure, you can see the predictable time points that CRS occurred during the step-up dosing. Next, I wanted to move on to the EPCOR NHL-1 study. This was the pivotal phase 2 study of epcoritamab with some slight differences in dosing. There was also step-up dosing implemented. The dosing was subcutaneous, as I mentioned before. And in order to decrease the risk of cytokine release syndrome, there was a cycle 1 dose optimization cohort that implemented an additional step-up dose, additional hydration, and CRS prophylaxis with dexamethasone, and in this cohort, hospitalization was not mandated. So in this study, there were 128 patients in the pivotal cohort, 86 patients in the cycle 1 optimization cohort. Again, a heavily pretreated patient population, and of note, very few patients in this study and in the one mentioned before had received prior CAR-T. Here you can see overall response rate of 82%, complete response rate of 63%, and similar high overall response rates across high-risk patient subgroups as outlined in this figure. This is the progression-free survival, 18-month progression-free survival of about 50%. And within patients who achieved a complete response rate, you can see durable responses beyond 24 months. Looking at the safety, especially in the cycle 1 dose optimization cohort, cytokine release syndrome was seen in just under half of patients, and there were no grade 3 or higher CRS. And then lastly, odronextamab was studied in the ELM2 FL cohort. This drug was administered IV, a slightly different step-up dosing. Unlike the others, there's step-up dosing but also split dosing for the first few doses, and then patients are continued on therapy until either unacceptable toxicity or progression. Heavily pretreated patient population, 3 or more median prior lines of therapy, and about half of patients had progression of disease within 24 months. And here you can see in the entire cohort, median progression-free survival of 20 months, overall response rate similar to other bispecific antibodies, 80% with a CR rate of 73%, and improved durable responses among patients who had achieved a complete response. Safety also looked similar with the modified step-up dosing with the split dosing. CRS occurred in just over half of patients, with only one patient having a grade 3 or higher event. And this slide just is a summary comparing the CRS rates across the different bispecific antibodies occurring in between 44 and 56%, primarily low grade. And I also highlight here the low rates of neurologic toxicity with the bispecific antibodies, with no grade 3 or higher neurologic events seen across these studies. So lastly, in the last few minutes, I want to just highlight some of the future directions of bispecific antibodies in follicular lymphoma. And I would say the major themes that we're seeing in this disease are now the use of bispecific antibodies in combination with other therapies, as well as the movement of bispecific antibodies into earlier lines of therapy. So I'm not going to go through each of these, but I put this table here for your reference to just highlight the many number of trials that are going on with mosunetuzumab in follicular lymphoma. You can see that there are many occurring in the frontline setting and many that are occurring in combination with other drugs that we know are active in follicular lymphoma. I'll highlight a few. So this is the SWOG-2308 trial. This trial is looking at low tumor burden follicular lymphoma. These are patients who may be initiating a single agent rituximab, and they will be randomized in a one-to-one fashion to either rituximab or a single agent mosunetuzumab and followed. I'll also highlight this study, which was presented at ASH this year, which is the subcutaneous mosunetuzumab in the frontline for follicular lymphoma. And here at 12 months, the progression-free survival was 91%. And these were patients who did meet GELF criteria. And then I'll also mention the CELESTIMO trial in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. This is a randomized trial looking at mosunetuzumab in combination with lenalidomide compared to rituximab and lenalidomide. So a lot changing in this space with mosunetuzumab. This is also happening with the other mentioned bispecific antibodies in this table. I highlight a few different trials that are ongoing, some in the frontline setting with epcoritamab. I'll mention this trial, which is epcoritamab plus lenalidomide plus rituximab in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And here at ASH, they showed early data that shows that the median progression-free survival was not reached. And even in the progression POD24 population, the median PFS was 27.8 months, which is encouraging. And then I'll also mention the EPCOR-FL1 study in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, which is a randomized trial comparing this combination that I just mentioned to rituximab and lenalidomide. Lastly, I want to mention a few trials ongoing with odronextamab, many of which are named Olympia. So the Olympia 5 study is in the relapsed refractory space. Patients are randomized to odronextamab and lenalidomide and rituximab and lenalidomide. You can see a theme across the different bispecific antibodies with many similar studies being performed. This is Olympia 1. So in this, this is a frontline study in follicular lymphoma where patients are randomized to single agent odronextamab compared to rituximab with chemotherapy. That's investigator choice. And the safety cohort was presented at ASH and showed encouraging early data with overall response rate of 92%. So that study has been accruing, and with that, I will wrap up and pass the baton to Dr. Abramson.
Thank you, Dr. Crombie. What a beautiful summary of a number of studies exploring the expanding role of bispecifics. And now, catch the fun part. This is the consensus and the controversy. Spoiler alert. We have more consensus than controversy on this panel. I think that speaks to the collegiality in this room and within the lymphoma community. But we're going to start, as Dr. Love would say, regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, which third-line treatment would you most likely recommend for a patient with follicular lymphoma who experienced disease progression 3 years after frontline BR and a year and a half after second line R squared? So this patient is a non-POD patient in need of third line therapy. And here's the fun part. We had most of the panelists, well, all the panelists said for an octogenarian, mosunetuzumab. But for a slightly younger patient at 65, we had a lot of votes for mosun, but a couple of votes for other options, including AxiCell and EPCO. And Dr. Sen, I'm going to come to you and ask about when you think about using a drug like AxiCell in relapsed follicular.
Yeah, so that might have been a little unusual answer for me, because I tend to side with what I would think is the option of least toxicity. But I have to say that what I am impressed with is that CAR T-cell therapy trials in follicular lymphoma have been showing very durable control for some patients. It, you know, even though this patient is not a POD24, they've relapsed within 3 years of BR, where the average person gets 7 years plus. So that's kind of a relatively short duration. And then 18 months, you know, after their second line treatment, I guess I'm thinking if they're young, they're healthy, maybe we come in with a one and done, you know, that is a little bit maybe heftier in a patient that seems to be relatively refractory.
Yeah, and I tend to think the younger a patient is, the more I'm going to think about CAR, even though I think you'll see we're more often than not thinking about mosun and an indolent disease like follicular lymphoma. I know Dr. Nastipal, who's not here to defend her vote so we can talk about her all we want, suggested EPCO. And listen, we just saw lots of data showing multiple effective bispecifics. Dr. Crombie, we've got two available, one potentially on the way. How do you decide between the different bispecifics in follicular lymphoma?
That's a really good question, and you can see from the data that I presented that there's a lot of similarities, but there are a few key differences that help me decide when I'm in that situation. And I think in follicular lymphoma, I am often thinking of ease of administration. And so with mosunetuzumab, it is a time-limited therapy. It is dosed every 3 weeks, and the response rates are very favorable and the toxicity is low. For epcoritamab, it's subcutaneous, the dosing is a little more frequent, and it's indefinite therapy. So for me, I'm often, I've seen patients prefer that time-limited approach. There are examples where I may think about using epcoritamab in follicular lymphoma, and we know that there's a dual approval for epcoritamab in large cell lymphoma and in follicular lymphoma. So sometimes I have a patient that may have a concern for a transformation, a more aggressive disease. They may be younger, and I might choose epcoritamab in that setting. The toxicity of mosunetuzumab, although we can't directly compare, does seem slightly more favorable.
Yeah, and when I've got a patient who, boy, they just smell a little bit like they're transformed, you've maybe biopsied them twice, you haven't quite found it, that's also an area where I might prefer a CAR, but certainly something like EPCO. So, you know, this we had broad consensus, and it gets to just what you were talking about, Dr. Crombie. You have access to all of these. Which would you use today, mosun or EPCO? Most of us are choosing mosun. Lori, any different perspectives?
No, I do agree. I think the efficacy is comparable between the different agents, but I do think the administration schedule for mosunetuzumab is a little bit easier, and I do think that finite therapy is probably most suitable for the majority of patients. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't use the agents that were designed more as a treat to progression as finite, but I think we still don't have data in that regard, and I'm sure it'll emerge from real-world data eventually.
Yeah, I agree. I think the time-limited part is key. The more we learn with these drugs, the more we see that the dominant cause of non-relapse mortality is infections, and a continuous depletion of B cells might not be in every patient's best interest or most patients. So the next question comes to the comparative efficacy, and I think we've heard this already. I think the general impression is mosun and EPCO work about the same. The differences are really in the logistics, in the frequency of administration, and the duration of therapy, time-limited with mosun versus continuous with epcoritamab. Broad consensus there. Now, we saw the data on odronextamab that Jen nicely presented, and most people here have said, yeah, it should be FDA approved. We had one, Dr. Nastipal said, she's not so sure it should be approved, and I guess one question that I'm wondering, and I'll go back to you, Dr. Crombie, is Odro is now approved. You've got all three of these available. Are you going to use odronextamab over the other two available options?
Yeah, I think if I had all available, I still would favor the current approved options just because of ease of administration. I did mention for the step-up dosing for odronextamab, it is unique in that not only is there a step-up dose, but there's also split dosing. So that's just an additional day that the patient has to return to clinic. I think it probably is safe to do in the outpatient setting, but it's still less convenient. So unless there was some other factor that made a bispecific available versus not, if they had odronextamab, if I had all three available, I'd choose the other two.
And it is also continuous therapy.
And it's continuous therapy, yeah.
Great. Okay. Now, would you employ bispecific antibodies in sequence in the same patient for follicular lymphoma? Now, I was an outlier on the panel. Not broadly. You'll see it was 3-3 where I said I would use it. I'll defend myself first. And I can imagine we use rituximab in, you know, the first 12 lines of therapy. And I can certainly see giving a bispecific antibody in multiple lines of therapy as long as the patient wasn't refractory. So if I gave a patient mosun, say, in third line and they had a really nice response, they relapsed 3 years later, and I've got nice data for epco-len, I'd be very comfortable giving that regimen. But is there a reason why you would think not to give different bispecifics in the same patient, Dr. Sen?
Yeah, no, I agree. If the patient has had a gap in treatment and a prior benefit, I don't see a reason why you wouldn't consider retreating with a similar type of agent. But what I don't think makes a lot of sense is going from one bispecific antibody to the next if a patient's progressing through or shown refractoriness, because there's no reason to believe that they're unique enough that they'd benefit from, you know, trying a different one.
Absolutely. And that's a lesson we've learned with CAR T cells, too. If you're going to use one CD19 CAR T cell and it doesn't work, you're not going to go to another CD19 CAR T cell. This is really a function if they respond, have a remission, and then can consider retreatment. So outside of a clinical trial, we've talked about follicular today. We all know that bispecifics are also approved in large cell lymphoma. Question to the panel, would you like to see bispecifics available anywhere else? And pretty much everyone said, yeah, we'd like to see everywhere else. Every CD20 positive disease, we'd love to see a bispecific antibody available for those patients. So I think we have broad consensus there. And so with that, it'll take us to our second module. You've heard beautifully about bispecifics. We're going to talk about the other major immunotherapy that's transforming the way we approach B-cell lymphomas. And of course, that's CD19-directed CAR T-cell therapy, which I'll have the pleasure of talking to you about. These are my disclosures. So this is how I usually approach follicular lymphoma. I'm not going to dwell on this today, but in general, I'm thinking for a high tumor burden, advanced stage follicular lymphoma, I'm giving typically still chemoimmunotherapy in the frontline setting. In the second line setting, I'm usually going to rituximab, lenalidomide, often now with the addition of tafasitamab, a little teaser for what you'll hear about from Lori in a few minutes. But then in the third line setting is where we now have approvals for these novel immunotherapies, both CAR T cells and bispecific antibodies. And so it's in that realm where I start to think about the currently approved bispecific antibodies. And of course, if they got a different third line option, then I'm thinking about that in the fourth line setting. So let's look at the data quickly for these CAR T cells, specifically in follicular lymphoma. Well, this is axicabtagene ciloleucel, the anti-CD19 CD28 co-stimulated CAR T-cell. These are five-year results from the ZUMA-5 trial, so these are nice, mature results that were updated at last year's ASH meeting. You can see a robust complete response rate approaching 80%, and at 5 years, half of patients remain progression-free. Now, remember, these patients had had three prior lines of therapy, so these were heavily pretreated follicular lymphoma patients, and this speaks to a fairly encouraging duration of remission and freedom from progression. We do know that axi-cel is the most toxic of the FDA-approved CAR T-cells. The majority of patients on this study did develop cytokine release syndrome, and the majority of patients on this study did develop neurologic toxicities. Now, not all of them develop severe toxicities, only a minority. But here, 6% of patients develop severe CRS, and 15% of patients had severe neurologic side effects. So this is an important consideration, especially in an indolent disease like follicular lymphoma. We know that other side effects we think about are prolonged cytopenias. About a third of patients still have grade 3 or higher cytopenias at 1 month after treatment. And infections, of course, and we see severe infections in this study at about 15% at 5 years of follow-up. Ticagrelor is a 4-1BB co-stimulated CAR T-cell, which has a more muted toxicity profile in large cell lymphoma and in follicular lymphoma. Now, an emphasis I'll note about the ALARA trial is that these were more heavily pretreated patients than in the other pivotal studies. This was a median of 4 prior lines of therapy, and there were more patients with POD24. So this was a higher-risk CAR T-cell population. That said, the CR rate was excellent, approaching 70%. And at 4 years follow-up, half of patients remain progression-free, so looking generally similar. There is a lower risk of side effects here. Only a minority of patients developed any CRS and neurotoxicity. There was no high-grade CRS in this study, and high-grade neurologic side effects were only 3%. We still saw prolonged cytopenias after a month in about a third of patients, but infections were reportedly low at 5%. And then finally, lisocabtagene maraleucel, another 4-1BB co-stimulated CAR T-cell. Less mature data. We just saw 4 and 5 year data for axi-cel and tisa-cel. This is 2 year data from the Transcend Follicular Lymphoma trial. These patients also had a median of three prior lines of therapy. And what you can see is a remarkably high CR rate in patients in the third line or later setting. The CR rate was 94%. There was also a second line cohort with POD24 at 96%. At 2 years for the third line and later patients, 73% of patients remain progression free at 2 years. Obviously, longer follow-up is needed. And in those early POD second line patients, a very encouraging 2 year PFS of 83%. We see with this product, which is 4-1BB co-stimulated like tisa-cel, very low rates of severe CRS and neurotox at 1% and 2% respectively, with the majority of patients having no CRS or neurotox at all. Prolonged cytopenias reported about 20% of patients and infections in about 10%. So a generally very well tolerated and also effective, but not as long follow-up as the other products. Since we do think a lot about where we would target CAR T cells and maybe thinking about the more high-risk patients, I circled here in red those patients who were POD24 and pulled them out where it was done in their pivotal studies. And what you can see among POD24 patients on the Transcend study, among patients treated with lisa-cel in the third line or later setting, two-thirds of those patients remained progression-free at 2 years, even if they had POD24 from frontline therapy. That was 50% at 4 years in the tisa-cel trial. And the specific number wasn't reported for ZUMA-5, but it was reported as consistent. We shall take them at their word. Now, another question that come up is sequencing of therapy. And we love bendamustine in follicular lymphoma, don't we? And yet we've heard, geez, bendamustine poisons T-cells, and then we want to collect those T-cells and then turn them into a CAR. Is that a great idea? Because we know in large cell lymphoma, if you've had recent bendamustine, it turns out you don't make a very good CAR T-cell. Well, the good news in follicular lymphoma is most patients respond beautifully to bendamustine in the frontline setting, as you heard about from Dr. Sen. And so the time that those patients would ultimately need a CAR T-cell is likely years later, not months later, because most patients have multi-year remissions after bendamustine-based therapy. But we do have some hint of data from both the lisa-cel and axi-cel studies. In the lisa-cel study, if we look at patients who received prior benda or no prior benda, both had high CR rates of 94%. But a signal emerges for those patients who received early, who received CAR T-cells within 6 months of prior bendamustine, or rather within 1 year of prior bendamustine, where their 24-month PFS was only 50% compared to 74% for patients who received no prior bendamustine. And once patients are beyond a year, at least in the lisa-cel trial, their progression-free survival actually looks similar to the non-benda patients. So certainly within a year with lisa-cel, that appears high risk and something to be avoided. Axi-cel, similar, maybe slightly different. We do see that for those patients who had prior bendamustine within 6 months, the outcomes with CAR were really disappointing. 25% PFS at 2 years if you got benda within 2 years, within 6 months. If we get beyond 6 to 12 months, it looks more like 70%. And beyond 1 year, it's reported as 50%, though the numbers here are small. What I would say is certainly early bendamustine exposure and subsequent CAR is a bad idea. If you've got patients who you've just had bendamustine, CAR is probably not the best option for those patients. But if it was distantly administered, I would say CAR is fine if they've had it more than a year or two in reverse. What about long-term safety? The more we think about these drugs, we need to think about long-term safety. Well, we know prolonged cytopenia, as I mentioned, about 20 to 30% at 30 days, but most of that abates by day 60. And in fact, if we look at 2 years or 1 year for lisa-cel, we see that the incidence of prolonged cytopenias is only about 3% when you get out beyond a year. Secondary malignancies are ranged between 6 and 10%, and I would argue are within the range of one would expect in a heavily pretreated follicular lymphoma patient, because this includes things like non-melanoma skin cancers, etc. But this is a reminder that we need to partner with both the academic and referring institutions to manage the long-term risk of these patients, infectious risks, monitoring for prolonged cytopenias, monitoring for prolonged hypogammaglobulinemia, considering replacement of IVIG in the setting of recurrent infections, thinking about revaccination strategies, and thinking about opportunistic infections in these patients who can have prolonged CD4 lymphopenia. There are randomized trials ongoing. There's the ZUMA 22 trial, which is looking at axi-cel versus standard of care in patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma. This is primarily for patients in the third line or later setting, but patients with only one prior line of therapy and POD24 are eligible, and the standard of care arm will get R-CHOP, R-BENDA, or R-LEN. The LIDA trial is a similar design with tisagel versus standard of care. This is limited to patients in the third line or later setting, and the only standard of care options on this study are R-CHOP or R-BENDA or R-lenalidomide, and PFS is the endpoint for both studies. And then I want to finish by just commenting on how we decide between CAR T cells and bispecific antibodies. You heard about bispecifics from Dr. Crombie. I've just talked to you about CAR T cells. There's a little conventional wisdom that says they all kind of work about the same, but CAR T cells are a lot more toxic. And what I want to highlight here is something that Dr. Sen kind of alluded to, which is if you look at these studies across the board, the CAR studies on top and the bispecific studies below, the CR rates tend to be higher with the CAR T cells. And on the right, the 24-month PFS and the median PFS tend to be longer with CAR T cells than bispecific antibodies. Dramatically, no. But if I've got a high-risk patient that I really want to maximize efficacy, I'm thinking about a CAR T cell in that high-risk younger patient because the efficacy might just be a little bit better. Now, are CAR T cells much more toxic? Let's dispute that right here and now. Because I would argue, particularly if you ignore axi-cel, which I think is too toxic a drug for follicular lymphoma when we've got liso-cel and tisa-cel available, that the incidence of severe CRS and ICANS are virtually identical across the board. Very low. It's higher with axi-cel, but really not higher with liso-cel and tisa-cel. And if you look at infections, guess what you see? More grade 3 or higher infections in the bispecific antibody trials. And I think this reflects the longer duration of B-cell depletion. And so I would say that all of these are effective drugs and warrant consideration by shared decision-making on a patient-by-patient basis. So let's move to our questions and think more about consensus and controversy. And so here's a first question and kind of a straightforward one is just thinking about referral basis and asking our experts, what proportion of patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma in the community would be good candidates for CAR T cells? How many of patients who are good candidates for CAR T cells are actually being referred for CAR T cells? And what you look here is it looks generally the impression is of a small minority, estimating as low as 20% for my estimation, middle ground of about a third for Dr. Sen and about topping out at 40% for Dr. Crombie. So let me ask Dr. Crombie, what are the obstacles? Why do you think the majority of patients who might be candidates for CAR in follicular are not being referred?
Yeah, I guess I'm the optimistic provider here.
Well, it's still just 40%, so you're not that optimistic.
I imagine that some of the barriers include just distance to the treating facility. You still need to come to a larger center that has comfort with CAR administration to receive these. Many patients with follicular lymphoma are older. They don't want to travel. They may still need to identify a caregiver to even bring them to talk about the therapy. So I think those are probably the key things rather than in large cell where it may be the disease pace. In follicular lymphoma, it may be the patient and more of the logistics.
Yeah, I agree. And I think another thing was probably just there are more options in the community. I mean, bispecifics, of course, which you talked about so elegantly. And you're going to hear tons of other options that can be given easily and safely closer to home from Dr. Sen. And so there might be less of an impetus to refer patients to travel a long distance, relocate to that center, et cetera. And that's why when we asked experts when they're typically thinking about CAR for their patients, it's typically third or fourth relapse for most patients. And what that means is fourth or fifth line of therapy. So really, if I'm sort of reading the tea leaves here, it sounds like most patients are really thinking chemo, Len, maybe a bispecific before thinking about CAR. Lori, what are your thoughts on that sequencing?
Yeah, I do think it needs to be individualized. And I think it's a moving target. So right now, they're both, you know, uniformly sort of approved in the third line setting. Most patients, I tend to go to bispecifics ahead just because of the comparative toxicities, although I think you're making a strong argument. They may not be as disparate as we sort of have this sense. But I do think, you know, it's highly likely that bispecifics will sort of jump forward a little bit and move into the second line, if not front line setting eventually. So it most likely CAR T won't be as readily kind of moving forward. So right now, I think they're both options. Third line, usually go to a bispecific, but I think it's an individual discussion with patients.
Yeah, and certainly CAR is more logistically complex, the travel, the manufacturing, the time, the need for lymphodepleting chemotherapy. So this next question was, if you were to estimate a patient with follicular lymphoma asks you, Dr. Crombie, on average, if I get CAR T cells, when will I need another treatment? Because this can be a compelling thing. Patients like to be off treatment. Most people here said about 5 years. Some people a little shorter, some a little longer. What's your impression on the durability of these CARs?
Yeah, I think we don't know for sure if it's a curative therapy, but there definitely seems to be patients who have these very prolonged responses, and we saw that with your presentation with the flattening of those progression-free survival curves. And so I estimated approximately 5 years. That may be based on the AxiCell data, which we have the longest follow-up for, but I do think it can be a long time. It could even be longer.
Right. Yeah, those certainly can be durable. And I've got patients who haven't relapsed 20 years after RCVP, so it's an incurable disease. But some patients can be remarkably prolonged, perhaps functionally cured in certain settings. Based on published research data and our own clinical experience, how would you indirectly compare the global efficacy and tolerability of AxiCell, LysaCell, and TysaCell? And I think I was blatantly sharing my opinions on this subject. Maybe Dr. Sen, you can take us through, you know, regulatory issues and approval issues aside, and what, depending on what you have available, how would you think about the different products in follicular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about the neurologic toxicity with AxiCell, as you said, for a patient with indolent lymphoma, and particularly when there are options that seem equally effective. You know, I would say that unless the patient, well, even if I thought they were transformed, I think LysaCell and AxiCell in my mind have sort of comparable efficacy, and maybe I'm being persuaded more by, you know, if, just in case there's that occult transformation, would I prefer to use LysaCell or TysaCell? Probably the LysaCell covers all options here. So I think LysaCell has the more favorable toxicity profile, and it's also going to cover, you know, that scenario where maybe there's an occult thing going on here.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And then, you know, there was a little more disagreement in the high symptomatic bulky, and maybe I'll ask Jen, you know, where would you reach for AxiCell over LysaCell and use this case as an example?
Yeah, there are cases where you might consider AxiCell if the patient, like as in this case, was young and fit and able to tolerate some of the side effects that we know we can see with AxiCell. There is a very reliable manufacturing with AxiCell that we see in large cell lymphoma, and sometimes follicular lymphoma, even though it is indolent, can be behaving in this difficult to treat, rapidly progressing fashion. And so with these durable responses that we see now with long-term follow-up in someone like that, it may be appealing to reach for AxiCell.
Yeah. And I think there has some conventional wisdom has emerged that because the toxicity is more with AxiCell, it must be a stronger CAR T cell. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the efficacy data holds that up. I think the CR rates and durability look pretty much identical. So I tend to think, I don't think a more aggressive patient should get AxiCell than LysaCell. I think they work equally. But, you know, you do get axi-cel manufactured quicker. And while that isn't usually a factor with follicular lymphoma, if that on average 1 week of getting the product quicker, then that's certainly where I would think about axi-cel, because you're right, it is very reliable manufacturing. Then this next question, we've got an 80-year-old, otherwise healthy patient with relapsed follicular lymphoma. You've decided to give CAR. What do you prefer for an octogenarian? We have broad consensus around here, and I think from a toxicity perspective, you've all heard us say, well, Isocel's pretty darn well tolerated, and Axicel will be tougher. I will say Tisocel is another option here, although I think we've seen in general, Isocel has very consistent data across multiple histologies. And then the next question is, we all know that the REMS program has been removed from these products. And one question is, will removal of the REMS requirement improve access to CAR T-cell therapy? And people said, maybe. Jen?
Yeah, I think that it will be easier for us to administer. We did have a lot of strict rules of requiring the patient to remain within close proximity for a month. They couldn't drive for extended periods of time. And I think some of that was overkill. And so now we're liberalized there. But even with the lifting of restrictions, there are still limitations and just logistical barriers that are part of CAR-T. You still have to travel. You still have to stay for a certain amount of time. And while it may be shorter, those restraints are still there.
Hence the somewhat. Agreed. All right. Well, that's a perfect segue into Dr. Sen, who's going to talk about all the other tremendous options available in follicular lymphoma.
Great. All the others in 8 minutes. So I'm going to run through a select group of what I would say are probably emerging as therapies that are now commonly being used. Aside from the immunotherapies we already talked about, these are my disclosures. So the first data I want to talk about is data from the InMind trial, which many of you are already familiar with. This was a trial that explored the addition of tafasitamab, which is a CD19-directed monoclonal antibody, to the common backbone of R-squared in patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And the rationale here is that as a monoclonal antibody similar to rituximab, it does induce direct cytotoxicity, but it also helps to enhance the function of NK and T cells, so hopefully will synergize with that R-squared backbone. So InMind was a very large phase 3 trial performed internationally that was double-blinded and placebo-controlled. It included patients who were adults with grades 1 to 3A follicular lymphoma primarily. There was a small group with marginal zone that it was not powered for and will be reported separately. But essentially what was reported was the outcome in follicular lymphoma patients. Patients had to have one prior line of therapy. So it compared head-to-head the standard regimen of 12 cycles of R-squared, as is commonly used, in one arm with the addition of tafasitamab in the experimental arm, and here the TAFA was given as per standard dosing. Initially, basically in cycles 1 to 3, it was given weekly and then every 2 weeks to complete the 12 cycles. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. The characteristics were comparable between the two arms. Basically, the median prior lines of therapy was one, but 45% of patients had received at least two prior lines of therapy. And I think what is quite noteworthy is that there was quite a high number of patients with POD24, which is about a third of patients, and approximately 40% of patients were actually refractory to anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies. So this was the primary endpoint of the trial. Progression-free survival by investigator was markedly improved with the addition of tafasitamab, so the median PFS went from 13.9 months to 22.4 months. Other endpoints were also improved significantly, so the CR rate and the overall response rate were both augmented with the tafasitamab. The trial had in a pre-planned analysis of various subgroup analyses, mainly of those groups of patients that we know to be higher risk. The main ones I'd point out are the three at the bottom, so patients who have POD24, patients who are refractory to prior anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies, and according to the number of lines of therapy. So these three factors were all part of the stratification factors for the randomization. So the clinical characteristics should be relatively balanced between the arms. And you can see that the tafasitamab improved outcomes regardless of those factors, and it improved it for both the high risk and the low risk for all of those individual factors. Just pointing out the curves here, again, for those POD24 patients, which we all worry about, a notable improvement in PFS. And for those patients with one prior line of therapy, where I think R-squared is now very commonly being used, again, the TAFA improved outcomes. Recently at ICML, more subgroups were looked at, and I think the ones that people often ask about, this is a form of immunotherapy. Does it matter if you get bendamustine before or not? And looking at the kinds of chemotherapy, it didn't seem to matter. Also didn't seem to matter whether or not you had high-risk FLIPI or high-grade disease. At this point in time, no difference in overall survival, though. What about toxicities? It was relatively well tolerated, so we're all familiar with using R-squared probably in our own clinics. The only difference I would say with adding the tafasitamab was that there was a slightly higher risk of some infections. So the neutropenia rate was not different, but slightly higher risk of pneumonias and COVID-19, which probably is not surprising because we anticipate there is probably a higher degree of B-cell suppression. But there was no impedance in the ability to deliver the lenalidomide. The other question I think that comes up frequently is, this is a CD19 targeting antibody. You know, do we have to be worried about that? We might want to come in with a CD19 directed CAR. There's still limited data for follicular lymphoma. I think more data in DLBCL suggests loss of CD19 is relatively rare after tafasitamab. In this trial, with 8 patients tested so far, following relapse with biopsies available, 7 out of 8 still maintained CD19 expression. What about other agents? So we know that the B-cell receptor pathway is instrumental for most B-cell lymphomas, including follicular lymphoma. We're not going to talk about PI3 kinase inhibitors today. They've long sort of gone by the wayside off the market. But BTK inhibitors have actually reemerged as a hot topic for follicular lymphoma. We know that ibrutinib, in preliminary evaluation as a single agent combined with rituximab, more recently combined with other agents, really hasn't seemed to pan out as an important agent for follicular lymphoma. So I think it was interesting when we all saw the data from Rosewood, which explored zanubrutinib, so a next-generation BTK inhibitor that is a higher level of specificity for BTK and less off-target toxicity. Here it was combined with obinutuzumab in a randomized phase 2 trial where the comparator was obinutuzumab alone. And what we saw is that essentially, this was a pretty high-risk patient cohort. Again, you know, the median number of prior lines of therapy here was 3, and many of them had been refractory to prior therapies. And importantly, the patients getting the combination of zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab had a marked improvement in overall response rate, which went from 46% to almost 70%, and really a doubling of the CR rate here from 19 to 39%. And this translated it into improved progression-free survival, where you can see here the median PFS went from 10 months up to 28 months with a zanubrutinib. So I think that was really intriguing data, and it now has been FDA-approved and also even Health Canada-approved, where I work. But there is a phase 3 MAHOGANY trial that will be testing this in a larger cohort of patients, where patients for the follicular arm will be randomized either to the zanubrutinib obinutuzumab or R-squared. Moving forward with just a few other agents that are currently undergoing evaluation that are not yet approved. So I think more enthusiasm now for the resurgence of the possibility of BTK inhibitors in follicular lymphoma. We saw recent data from the BellWave trial that explored nemtabrutinib, which is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor under evaluation. Here is a single agent. We did see modest activity with an overall response rate of 40%, still very early data, but this will likely go on to further evaluation in combinations. Also, golcadomide, I think, is agent that's emerging, and there is just an onslaught of studies and variety of B-cell lymphomas being explored with golcadomide. But this is a novel CELMoD under development. And in follicular lymphoma, we've seen some early data exploring either the single agent activity of golcadomide or combined with rituximab. And I think what was noteworthy here is, you know, in this early study, we saw very, very high overall response rates, which, you know, largely ranged between 80 and 100% and very high CR rates for what was quite a highly pretreated patient population. So I think more to come using that CELMoD in different combinations. And maybe just skipping forward, the last thing I'll mention is I think some really intriguing early data looking at the antibody drug conjugate loncastuximab tesirine. Of course, this is a CD19-directed antibody drug conjugate. And in this single-arm study, it was combined with rituximab in a group of patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And of course, the response rates, I think, are what's most intriguing. It was 97% with a 75% CR rate with still relatively early follow-up, but you can see that that curve of progression-free survival remains quite high beyond the 18-month mark. So I think that is going to go on to further exploration as well. And I'll pass it back to you, Dr. Abramson.
Thank you, Dr. Sen. A great discussion on a varied range of targeted therapies, which is terrific. So why don't we next move to some of our consensus and controversies, and we'll start by thinking about a 65-year-old patient with follicular lymphoma who experienced disease progression 3 years after starting frontline BR followed by maintenance rituximab. And the question now is, what second-line treatment would you administer after a patient who didn't have POD24? And we see most patients suggested tafasitamab R-squared. A couple people thinking maybe they think more about R-squared. I guess this gets to the question, Lori, you know, that we've got CARs sitting in reserve. We have other CD19 agents you just talked about. Should people have qualms about giving tafasitamab in a patient they might ultimately take to a CAR T-cell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that sequencing of agents is going to be probably the biggest topic that you'll hear about now in follicular lymphoma. We get all of these options now competing against each other. You know, I guess I'm reassured by the DLBCL data where there's more demonstration that the likelihood of CD19 loss is actually quite low. We're seeing it here from the InMind study where that likelihood seems quite low. So I don't think it would prohibit me from coming in with a TAFA R-squared platform ahead of other options. But I think, you know, it remains a consideration and something that needs to be discussed.
Terrific. And then the next question, again, sequencing. Would you administer TAFA R-squared in a patient who got CAR T-cells sequentially? And the question here has emerged as, some people said, sure, I have no problem with giving one CD19 treatment after another CD9 treatment. And others, myself included, said, yeah, but I'd want to know about CD19 expression first because I probably wouldn't give it if the tumor was CD19 negative. Dr. Crombie, what do you think about? Patients gotten TAFA R-squared. You're thinking about a CD19 CAR. Do you need to know the CD19 status?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a good idea to check if you're able to obtain a biopsy. It's as Lori mentioned, it's something that we're still learning about. We don't have a ton of data, so I think if you have the opportunity to biopsy, that would give you more reassurance as you move forward. I think in general with follicular lymphoma patients, it is also good to periodically get a biopsy to make sure you're still, there's not a transformation event which might change your treatment approach. So yeah, I think a biopsy is great if you can get one. If you couldn't get one, I still think I would feel comfortable proceeding in sequence knowing the data that we have so far.
Yeah, CD19 has been a fairly stable antigen after monoclonal antibodies. I think the rate of loss is much higher after CAR T cells. Maybe there's probably more selective pressure in that context. So now you have a patient who you administered, and the question is, would you give TAFA R-squared to a patient who previously got R-squared? broad consensus here. If a patient has already received and progressed after R squared, I guess maybe folks here, Dr. Sen, aren't thinking that TAF is that heavy a lifter in the absence of the LENR. What do you think?
You know, I mean, I would think that patients have other options to move on to. And probably as with any patient, what's missing there is, you know, how long a benefit that they had. If they had it, you know, 5 years ago and had really long benefit, you know, I think you can consider coming back in. But the reality is that we've got other options. And probably before I went and reused an R-squared platform, I'd probably be moving on to something else.
So in which line of therapy would you typically think about the Rosewood regimen? This is zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And looks like the majority of folks here said fourth relapse. That's fifth line of therapy. A couple of people saying might give it as early as the fourth line of therapy. Dr. Crombie, in your practice, where do you fit zanubrutinib, obinutuzumab in with the other options available?
Yeah, as was mentioned, I think we're having a growing number of treatment options, which is actually good for a patient because it can be personalized. So when I think about using this type of regimen, I'm thinking more about elderly, frail patients, maybe heavily pretreated. I do see patients who come from different parts of New England for a second opinion and don't want to, you know, they want to return to Maine and aren't interested in bispecifics or CAR. That might be a time when this is a great option for them. Or just a patient who has seen a lot of other therapies already.
You know, when somebody from Boston who practices in Boston talks about the hypothetical patient who won't want to come to Boston, they're always from Maine. Let me ask Dr. Sen, you know, it's not a topic of this question, but when I think about zanubrutinib, a well-tolerated oral agent, I'm also thinking about tazemetostat. Where does tazemetostat fit in today?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I do think that it probably is the agent that is easiest to administer with the least amount of toxicity, and that could have some appeal to patients who want an oral-only regimen. But I have to say that I do think its activity pales against most other options unless the patient is known to be EZH2 mutated, and probably many people around the room are not yet routinely testing for it. So I think it makes sense in an EZH2 mutated patient if you have that data and they're eager for an oral option. But aside from that, I just think the efficacy probably pales and I'd be going with something else.
Yeah. And if you're running out of options, check for Chen's and NGS panel, because the mutated patients, 20% or so, they can do quite well. But I agree with you. It has a decreasing role, I'd say, as we have emerging other options. And what other strategies might we be interested in follicular lymphoma? And we see a hodgepodge here. I mentioned Golca and other bispecifics. A lot of other bispecifics and the thought about combining them or moving them earlier. ADCs, a shout out to EZH2 inhibitors. Dr. Crombie, what are you most excited about on the horizon?
Well, I mentioned here using bispecifics in earlier lines of therapy. I think the thought of chemo-free strategies is very appealing for an indolent disease like follicular lymphoma. I like the idea of having that be the first treatment for patients. We've had a couple studies open at our institution that were single agent or just other CD20 antibodies with bispecific antibodies that have been very attractive for patients. So I'm excited to see the longer follow-up of those studies.
Great. And, you know, we got a question online, Dr. Sen, and I'm going to ask it to you. You've got a patient on a bispecific antibody. When do you decide when to stop that therapy, and do you use MRD?
Fantastic question. So I don't use MRD in routine practice in follicular lymphoma. I don't think we have a well-validated test for MRD in follicular lymphoma, but it is probably a test that we need to develop moving forward. So maybe we can make more rational decisions of where to stop agents like bispecifics. I'm a firm believer that bispecifics should be used in a finite way. So for the mosunetuzumab trial, obviously it was designed to be given finite. And after 8 cycles, you know, the majority of patients were able to stop because they were in a CR. We don't have the data for the other agents that were designed to be given to progression, but I think there has to be some analogous time point where those agents should probably be stopped. And so in my own clinical setting, I'd probably be thinking about a patient who's been in a CR and has reached at least the 12-month mark or so, and maybe that would be a rational point to stop. But there's no data, and I really hope that this starts to emerge from real-world evidence as it gets reported.
And speaking of rational times to stop, it's 12:47, the end point of our program. Thank you to our terrific faculty for joining us. Thanks to all of you joining us in person online. Fill out your surveys, get your credit. Enjoy the rest of SoHo. Thanks.